This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The Briefing Room is the metaversal thought capsule where in 28 minutes you and I get to understand a big issue with the help of the top experts on the subject. This week, what impact will Sinn Féin becoming the largest party in Northern Ireland have on local politics, the EU protocol and the union? Last week's elections in Northern Ireland saw Sinn Féin, the party whose aim is a united Ireland, win the most votes, pushing the unionist DUP into second place. In any new executive, this would lead to Sinn Féin's leader, Michelle O'Neill, becoming First Minister, which feels like a historic result. But is it? What will its impact on Stormont politics, on the UK-EU protocol, and the union itself end up being? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, those election results need some explaining. The briefing room's Rosamund Jones spoke to the BBC's political editor in Northern Ireland, Enda McClafferty.
Firstly, before we get into the actual results, what happens in Northern Ireland? This is a different system, isn't it, to what's in place for, say, electing MPs to Westminster?
In Northern Ireland, we operate the election system of proportional representation, the single transferable vote, that's how it's known locally. And that essentially is devised in a way to allow a greater share of the vote so that smaller parties have a better chance of getting politicians elected to the Northern Ireland Assembly. Voters are urged to vote for their candidates in order of preference. So they put number one beside their first choice, number two beside their second choice, and so on, right down the ballot paper.
Tell me about Sinn Féin. How many seats did they win? And how much did their overall vote share actually go up?
Well, there's a couple of interesting figures there. First of all, when it comes to seats, Sinn Féin's seat allocation didn't change. The party came into this election with 27 seats and it secured 27 seats. What has changed for Sinn Féin is the percentage increase in first preference votes. So their vote share went up 1.1% on the last election in 2017. What is interesting, though, is the gap between Sinn Féin and the DUP. Last time round, the DUP had a gap of around 1,500 first preference votes ahead of Sinn Féin. This time round, Sinn Féin has 60,000 plus votes ahead of the DUP. So that's why I suppose there's a greater focus on that figure in terms of where Sinn Féin is sitting right now.
And so what happened to the unionist vote?
It essentially split because we have three unionist parties vying, if you like, for the unionist hearts and minds. We have the DUP, the largest of the unionist parties in Northern Ireland. They returned with 25 seats now. That was three down on what the party held going into this election. They were on 28, and the DUP saw their vote go down 6.7%. Now, where did that vote go is a question. Well, it's pretty obvious when you look at the final tallies that many of their voters, disillusioned it has to be said, went with the hardline traditional unionist party in Northern Ireland because their vote increased by around 5%. They managed to get 60,000 plus votes. But what is interesting about the TUV is that they only had one member of the Legislative Assembly coming into this election. So the party has returned with just one seat as well. And that's because the TUV are not transfer friendly.
So basically the DUP and TUV voters will only transfer votes to each other.
Exactly.
So it sounds to me as actually as if the union vote overall didn't actually decline much.
No.
Now, before you tell me what happened to the Alliance Party, can you just briefly tell me what they stand for?
Yes, the Alliance Party was the big success story, if you like. The Alliance Party is all about trying to move away from the traditional orange and green politics in Northern Ireland, offering voters something different, if you like, sort of a more progressive look, very much into integrated education and very much striving towards pulling communities together as opposed to saying or doing anything that might drive wedges between communities. And it has been very clear of late that more and more people are getting disillusioned with the orange and green politics and they're turning to the middle ground party. And if you look at how they performed this time, an amazing result, really. They have gone from 8 seats right up into 17 seats and they increased their vote share by 4.5%.
Can you now explain how the Good Friday Agreement affects who ends up in government and with whom?
Yes, we have a very complicated system of government in Northern Ireland, like no other, I would dare say. And it basically is a mandatory coalition. So if you can imagine, we had Northern Ireland coming out of conflict, how best to deal with the political parties here. And the solution was to force them basically to work together in government. You must be in government with the other side. One can't move without the other. And that sometimes doesn't lead to good government when it comes to big decision making. You might find five parties in government in the morning making decisions and the same five parties in opposition in the afternoon pulling apart decisions which have been made by ministers from other parties. So it is kind of a bizarre template for politics, but it's the one we're left with in Northern Ireland, and that was the one that was shaped by the Good Friday Agreement.
So what's the situation post-election now? What's the reason the DUP is giving about why they won't take up the deputy post?
What has happened is that the DUP have said that they're not up for sharing power until the Northern Ireland Protocol issue has been resolved. And just to briefly outline what the protocol is, this was the part of the Brexit withdrawal agreement signed between London and Brussels that ensured that there was going to be no hard border on the island of Ireland. But what the protocol has essentially done has placed the border down the middle of the Irish Sea. So in other words, goods travelling from GB into Northern Ireland need to be checked because then there's a potential that they could move into the Republic. And that is, of course, the EU single market. Of course, that has angered unionists. They view the Northern Ireland Protocol in terms of identity. Their identity has been weakened within the wider UK because they're still under the control of Brussels. Where others look at the Northern Ireland Protocol simply in economic terms as something which needs to be in place to protect the EU single market. And that's why it's such a difficult nut to crack. And that's why the DUP has taken a stand and said we are not sharing power until the protocol issue has been resolved. So Michelle O'Neill, as it stands right now, Sinn Féin's the largest party. She is entitled to hold the post of First Minister. But she can't hold that post of First Minister unless the DUP agree to hold the post of Deputy First Minister. So if one doesn't buy into the process, then the other post cannot be filled. And that's where we are right now.
Enda McClafferty. So for the moment, paralysis at Stormont. What does that mean for how Northern Ireland is governed? Anne Watt is director of Pivotal, an independent public policy think tank in Belfast, and Sam McBride is Northern Ireland editor of the Belfast Telegraph and Sunday Independent. Sam McBride, this paralysis, has this happened before in the period since the Good Friday Agreement?
It has happened too many times for me to easily recall. Since 1998, since the Good Friday Agreement, we've had government in Northern Ireland, a devolved executive for just over 60% of the time. So for now approaching 40% of the time, we have not had a government.
And could you take me through what the situation's been more recently in the last few years?
Let's go back to January 2017. So the Sinn Féin Deputy First Minister pulled out of the executive over the DUP's role in the RHI scandal. That was a scandal about a renewable heating scheme where there was huge criticism of the DUP's role in terms of the use of public money and allegations of corrupt practice. And then despite repeated rounds of political talks about restoring devolution, 3 years went past without an executive being formed or a new election being called. And then from January 2020 until February 2022, Northern Ireland did have a fully functioning executive and assembly in place. And that was obviously dominated by the COVID period. And then we got to February 2022, and the issue of Brexit and the protocol caused the DUP to withdraw their First Minister from post. And then Northern Ireland once again entered a period without an executive.
Sam, in practice, what has that meant for core areas like education, health?
Many big strategic decisions, particularly in health, where there are reforms that are now decades out of date, really, in Northern Ireland. We've had report after report saying that there are far too many small hospitals in Northern Ireland that don't have the modern expertise to be able to treat people effectively. They should be centralised into big centres of excellence. And so we have had this situation where either when Stormont is in existence, those difficult decisions haven't been taken, or we move into territory as we're in right now, where even if somebody did suddenly decide that they were going to take a bold decision, they don't have the authority to take it because there is no government.
And how's that impacted on the things that we often talk about, like waiting lists and educational priorities?
The context here is that Northern Ireland faces a multitude of immediate and longer term policy challenges. We've got the cost of living crisis. We've got the longest health waiting lists in the UK. In Northern Ireland, there are 355,000 people on a waiting list, and well over 50% of them have been waiting more than 1 year. The target is that no one should wait more than 1 year. I think the comparable figure in England is that about 5% of people have waited more than 1 year. We've got school budgets stretched to breaking point and lack of proper support for the most vulnerable children. We've got economic problems like low productivity and low skills. And the biggest issue is, without an executive, there can't be a budget which would prioritise the most important issues, might move money around between different areas of spending.
Sam McBride, what do we know about how the Northern Ireland public feels about the lack of effective government?
Well, what preceded the collapse of this government was very bad government. And so therefore, it was very unpopular. There was no sense of Stormont being a type of government or a series of individual ministers who were held in high respect by the public. And really, one of the few things which was capable of bringing these ministers together often was the idea that London should send a bigger check to pay for whatever it was that they wanted to do. Everything was somebody else's fault. Nothing was their responsibility. But if Northern Ireland is going to work, devolution is probably the only way by which it can be governed. And so we have seen people moving from both unionist parties and nationalist parties, voting for the Alliance Party, this party in the centre ground in Northern Ireland, which doesn't take a stance on those old arguments about whether Northern Ireland should be British or Irish. And they are the people who increasingly are mopping up these really browned off voters who are not accepting what has gone before.
And what is any of this leading people to question the way in which Northern Ireland government was organised under the terms of the Good Friday Agreement?
The Good Friday Agreement is the foundation stone upon which the power sharing arrangements are built. It was deliberately set up so that power has to be shared between the two main designations, unionist and nationalist. But I think there's a growing sense that the arrangements need to evolve over time, given changing circumstances, and that's already happened in previous political deals. The biggest issue at present is that one of the two main parties can prevent an executive being formed, as is happening right now. And that's an inevitable consequence of a mandatory coalition arrangement where power has to be shared. But how it's been used recently and the continued threat that it provides certainly stands in the way of stable government, as we've seen now and as we saw in 2017 to 2020. So either mandatory coalition needs to work, or we need to change their model where an executive is formed between those parties willing to participate in government.
Sam McBride, it does mean that parties can stand on manifestos that have absolutely no chance of being implemented unless they're agreed with the other people in the coalition. So it doesn't really matter if you win or not particularly in terms of what policies get passed.
That is correct. And actually, it's much worse than that because there's no opposition to hold you to account. Almost everybody is in the government. That is slightly starting to change now. But I think that the Good Friday Agreement was incredibly successful at ending the Troubles, at bringing a period of stability and peace to Northern Ireland. And that is a very significant thing. But it was very unsuccessful at bringing good government to Northern Ireland. There's widespread agreement about that now. And so we have moved from a situation where there were some very hard-line unionists who were arguing for years that the Good Friday Agreement should be altered because they'd never supported it. They had never supported the idea of having Sinn Féin in government and things like that. Now we've moved to a position where the most moderate party, the Alliance Party, is leading the charge on this for different reasons, but basically getting to a very similar destination. And the growth in the vote for Alliance, where we've moved from a position where there were two big tribes in Northern Ireland, unionism and nationalism, to having three big tribes, this other tribe, which doesn't define along those old lines. That is straining the Good Friday Agreement to the point of breaking. It's going to have to be altered. It's just a question of whether it gets done now or whether we wait a few years and do it then when it collapses again.
And what we all remember, or those of us old enough, remember the phrase direct rule. Do you think the UK government is likely to get involved again? And if so, how?
Two things on this are important. First of all, the UK and the Irish governments have a role here as co-guarantors of the Good Friday Agreement. Over the years, we've seen the governments, both governments, take an active role in helping to resolve disputes between the parties. So many people will be looking to the UK government and the Irish government to step in to help restore devolution and get us through this particular impasse. The UK government can step in to legislate in Westminster on issues about Northern Ireland. It did that during the three-year period between 2017 and 2020. So, for example, on budget setting, on rate setting, on some public appointments. I would expect there to be a reluctance on the part of the UK government to intervene in that way, but they will do so if they have to. But they'll be reluctant because the UK government wants to incentivise the parties to get on with restoring an executive, and it won't want to bail them out easily in that way.
And what do Northern Ireland voters think, Anne, of the prospect of such rule?
If you look at the evidence from surveys, they overwhelmingly want devolution. They want decisions to be taken by locally elected politicians here. They don't want decisions to be taken at a distance. But if you ask them what they think of the executive that we've had, they give an overwhelmingly negative point of view. There was a recent Lucid Talk survey which rated the Northern Ireland executive's performance at minus 52. So the public think the executive is not delivering good government in Northern Ireland, but they do want devolution. They just want devolution that works.
And what they're on what people in Northern Ireland want. Now let's look at what's likely to happen with the famous protocol which the government signed with the EU, which the DUP opposes, and which UK ministers are now threatening to walk away from. And also, let's look at whether all this brings Irish unity any closer. Staying with us is Sam McBride, and joining us now is Etienne Tanham, Associate Professor of International Peace Studies at Trinity College Dublin. Sam McBride, let's start this section by talking about the ongoing impact of the protocol in Northern Ireland. What's happening there?
There are really two aspects to this. There is the economic aspect and there's the political aspect. In economic terms, there are companies which are making lots of money out of the protocol. It's good for their business. Some of that's because they've got a competitive edge. They've got a foot in both the UK and the EU markets. But that is really counterbalanced by the frankly breathtaking scale of some of the paperwork which faces companies now bringing products across the Irish Sea into Northern Ireland. We really have got rules here which I suppose would normally apply to big container loads, whole ships in some cases coming from China or India. Now those are applying to, in some cases, a single item or a single pallet moving from Great Britain to Northern Ireland. So it's incredibly complicated, particularly for small firms to navigate. That has hit consumer choice. Some companies are simply saying they won't sell to Northern Ireland anymore. But the most important aspect of this is that there are huge chunks of the protocol which have never been implemented. And there has also been really very significant, vast government spending to try to camouflage the bits of the protocol that have been implemented. So both of those things are going to change at some point. If the protocol stays, the money will run out. The bits that haven't been implemented will be implemented. And that's the point where we'll really see, I suppose, what this means. But this was never simply about economics. It was never simply about filthy lucre.
Is there a majority view in Northern Ireland, Sam, about the protocol and how important it is and what a priority it is?
There is a clear majority for the protocol, just as there was a clear majority for remaining in the EU in the referendum. But there is an added complexity to this in Northern Ireland. In most states, if there was a majority for something, it would be quite straightforward. That is the side that has won. Northern Ireland has not been run, however, along majoritarian lines since 1972. Polling suggests something like 40% of the population, which roughly correlates with the unionist population now in Northern Ireland. They are opposed to the protocol. They want it to be removed. That is almost perfectly matched on both the nationalist side and within centrist voters in people who support the protocol. So it is really divided Northern Ireland politics.
Now, do you think, Sam, that there is a form of flexibility that could be shown with regard to the protocol? We're talking primarily about whether the EU could relax some of the rules that you've been talking about that have led to that level of paperwork, that the DUP would accept.
Yes, I think that ultimately the DUP will accept some form of compromise on this. I think we've moved quite considerably to a position of acceptance that the protocol as it was agreed, the protocol as it exists in law and on paper, is actually unimplementable. And even the European Union has moved quite significantly there. For instance, they have now said that they don't want the medicines border that would have existed in the Irish Sea. That is no longer going to be put in place. So there is a move towards compromise. And the argument is, how far should that compromise go? I think the DUP can only compromise on this if they get significant wins. Some small sort of fig leaf is not going to be enough for the DUP, even if they wanted to accept it. Unionism in this election has shown itself to be hardening in this issue. And we've had key DUP figures, both on and off the record over recent days, saying that they think they only managed to cling on to as many seats as they did in last week's election because they had toughened their stance on this really so dramatically. So they have a mandate to stay out of government because of this issue. And even in those circumstances, they've lost an awful lot of votes to a party which is even more hardline on this issue.
Etain Tanam, what is the Republic's position about how much room for flexibility there should be in interpreting the protocol?
The Irish government has been lobbying very strongly for as much flexibility as the EU is able and willing to give. The preference for the Irish government is really to find a solution.
In very rough terms, what form might a flexibility acceptable to the Republic take?
Well, it's to be acceptable to the European Union. But the aim is to have, in the way that Sam has said, flexible arrangements, for example, that have been reached around medicines. I mean, we know what's puzzling about this generally, I suppose, is that since the foundation of the European Community and onwards, there have always been bespoke arrangements and flexibilities. So I think there is a landing zone possible around reducing tariff barriers, creating a sort of easy passage for categories of goods as far as possible and to a maximum amount, really. And I think that's where the focus of lobbying is.
Sam, after listening to the two of you, the listener might wonder what on earth this is all about, given that it would seem to be on the face of it possible to arrange some kind of agreement. And yet we have the Foreign Secretary saying that following the election in Northern Ireland, the UK might leave the protocol unilaterally. Now, is that a threat which is being taken seriously in Northern Ireland?
It's being taken seriously by both sides, but I think that both sides are scratching their heads as to whether they actually believe the government this time. There has been such an inherent dishonesty to how Boris Johnson and how his government, frankly, have approached this issue that it really makes it difficult to analyse what the words that they say might mean in practice. It's almost like the boy who cried wolf. And I think that is something which makes it both difficult for people to know what's happening here and also makes it very difficult for the European Union. If they do strike a compromise deal with him that might be good for all of us, how do they know if he's going to stick to it? How do they know if he's even going to admit to the public what it actually entails? It's a very unique situation in politics, I think, that we find ourselves in here.
Is that a common perception in Northern Ireland politics?
One of the few things on which people in Northern Ireland are united these days is that they do not trust Boris Johnson's government. There is overwhelming polling evidence. I think it's in the order of 80% of people in Northern Ireland do not trust Boris Johnson's government. That's pretty remarkable. but it's really clear. And it's because he has been so openly dishonest on the issue of the protocol and on what it would entail. Right up until this started and after the Irish Sea border was there, he said, no, this is not what it means. The checks were happening in front of people's eyes, and still the Prime Minister was denying the reality of what the text that he had agreed meant in practice for Northern Ireland.
If the UK government does unilaterally leave the protocol, under those circumstances, is it your understanding that the DUP would return to the executive and accept the post as Deputy First Minister under a Sinn Féin First Minister?
Yes, I don't have any doubt about that now. The DUP rather stupidly refused to answer that question during the campaign. That really was something which drove voters towards Sinn Féin out of distaste at what seemed like the DUP's really thumbing its nose at the democratic process if Sinn Féin were to win. They've been clearer after the election, saying, yes, there is no basis on which they can't go in if that's the only issue.
Now, how would Sinn Féin react to the unilateral leaving of the protocol? I mean, might they say, no, we're not having that, and now we're not going to be part of the executive?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I was at the Sinn Féin manifesto launch about 2.5 weeks ago, and they were asked this question. Mary Lou McDonald, the Sinn Féin leader, did not give a clear answer. When she was asked, well, actually, what's your view on this if it went the other way? She didn't rule out that Sinn Féin would then refuse to go into government. That's a bit opaque right now, but I think that there is at least the possibility that they say, hang on a minute, we have got some leverage in this process and we're now going to deploy it. I think that also there is a significant change in the landscape on the paramilitary front in Northern Ireland from the point at which this process began. The new IRA, the main dissident Republican, quite active terrorist organisation within Northern Ireland, has had its leadership decimated over the last year by MI5. And so therefore, there is more focus on the politics of how this would play than an immediate fear as to what it would mean in terms of blowing up border posts or anything of that nature.
Now, Etain, what would be the view in the Republic of a unilateral withdrawal from the protocol by the UK?
I think it's already clear. It's a very highly negative view. It's an undermining of trust, which is so central again to any bargaining situation and which has underpinned the British-Irish relationship until Brexit, until very recently. So there would be absolute opposition to that and obviously full support for the EU position on it as well.
Sam, what happens in Northern Ireland if the protocol goes? And now I'm not talking about how Sinn Féin would respond in terms of the executive. I'm talking about how it would affect the politics of Northern Ireland overall.
Well, it would further poison the politics here. I think that there would be a move onto the streets here almost, whichever side wins, if you like, because this was seen by nationalists when Brexit happened to have been a defeat for them. They had lost. It was then a defeat for unionists when the protocol was put in place because they didn't want the border within their own country. And so whichever way this goes, I think one side will feel, unless there is a clear compromise, something which does give something to both sides, I think they will really feel that they have fundamentally lost.
Etain, in Britain, we've seen some suggestions that the election results might make a united Ireland more possible. Now, that could only happen via what is called a border poll. So you're going to have to remind us what a border poll is and what the Good Friday Agreement says about having one.
The rule is that only the Secretary of State can call a referendum, which would be if it sees there is a volume of evidence over a sustained period that shows a majority would favour unification. So that's the formal rule. Majority support has to be found in both jurisdictions, so in Northern Ireland and in Ireland. And it is believed, again, that there would be a need for a referendum in Ireland as well, because the magnitude of constitutional change required if there was unification would require that approval. So that is the procedure, but again, it is not laid out in great detail.
When the Secretary of State theoretically makes such an adjudication, would they do it on the basis of election results or of sustained polling?
Probably a combination of all sources, election results and sustained polling.
Sam, would it be right to conclude from that the chances of a border poll actually are vanishingly small?
Right now, yes, absolutely. There is nothing in this election which brings a border poll closer. The biggest surge in this election was for a party, the Alliance Party in the centre ground, which explicitly basically has its entire policies formed around the idea of parking talk of a border poll, parking talk of constitutional change. They're not wholly opposed to it at some future point, but certainly not now. And even the Sinn Féin vote in this election was in response to a campaign from Sinn Féin, which was talking much more about things like inflation than about Irish unity. So it is really impossible, I think, for Sinn Féin to frame this now after the event as anything approaching a vote for a sudden or an urgent move towards a border poll.
That was Sam McBride with Etain Tannan. And my conclusion is that common sense would suggest that a middle way will be found on the protocol, and facts on the ground suggest a vote on a united Ireland is some way away. My thanks to Enda McClafferty, Anne Watt, Sam McBride and Etain Tannan. We'll be back at the same time next week. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Kirsty Knight, Ben Carter and Rosamund Jones. The programme was mixed by James Beard. The editor was Richard Varden. Another edition of this podcast will be along again really soon. If you enjoyed it, you can find many others on BBC Sounds.
Hi there, I'm just popping up to let you know about another Radio 4 podcast that you may be interested in. Especially if, like me, your social media feeds are constantly bombarding you with adverts that are hyping up the latest Wonder products, promising you the world. You know the ones, personalised vitamin plans to make you healthier, a pair of sustainable jeans to make you greener, NFTs to earn you millions. I am on a mission to find out the facts behind the fads. I'm Greg Foote, and my BBC Radio 4 podcast Sliced Bread is back to ask if another batch of these Wonder products really are the best thing since sliced bread. If you'd like to know about Manuka honey or mosquito repellent or mindfulness apps, or if you've got something you'd like me to investigate for you, just go search for Sliced Bread on BBC Sounds.